From Welcome Villain Films, the studio that brought you the horror hit Malum, as well as Beaten to Death and Hunter Killer, comes their newest nightmare, Mind, Body, Spirit, now available on digital. Directed by Alex Haynes and Matthew Miranda, and produced by Dan Asma, Mind, Body, Spirit follows Anya, an aspiring yoga influencer, as she embarks on a ritual practice left behind by her estranged grandmother. What starts as a spiritual self-help guide quickly evolves into something much more sinister, as Anya becomes increasingly obsessed with the mysterious power of the practice. She unwittingly unleashes an otherworldly entity that begins to take control of her life and her videos. Now, Anya must race to unlock the truth before her descent into madness threatens to consume her mind, body, and spirit. During its festival tour, with stops at Chattanooga Film Festival and the Unnamed Footage Festival, Mind, Body, Spirit garnered praise from critics who call it a found footage version of Hereditary and a knockout found footage horror movie for the live stream era. Experience the first ever yoga-themed found footage horror film, and don't miss the film viewers have called extremely frightening and upsetting. Available now on digital anywhere you rent or buy movies online, including Prime Video and Apple Plus.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Don't touch that dial. You're tuned in to the Dread Podcast Network.
Welcome to Development Hell. For every horror movie that hits VOD, countless others end up DOA. Development Hell is the podcast dedicated to unearthing these cursed horror productions. We're going to find out what went wrong and then decide if these titles still stand a shot at the green light. I am your host, Josh Korngut. I am the managing editor of Dread Central. I am also a filmmaker in Toronto, Canada. This podcast is a proud member of the Dread Podcast Network. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to a brand new episode of Development Hell. This month, every Tuesday, we are celebrating and unearthing an unmade film of the masterful George A. Romero with our limited series, Romero Unseen. Today is going to be the second episode of this limited audio series, and we're going to be unearthing Romero's never-made adaptation of the Resident Evil video game series. So fans, of course, did get a very lengthy major cinematic franchise based on these games, but the Romero iteration never saw the light of day. Joining me once again for Romero Unseen, we have with us a very special co-host. Joining us is Adam Charles Hart. So he is the author of the book Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. It is out today from Oxford University Press. The reason we're so excited about this book, well, one of the reasons is that it's the first scholarly work about Romero's massive archive of unfilmed scripts, and I would say this makes Adam the perfect guest host for a Development Hell miniseries. You can find where to buy the book in the episode notes. Adam, we're so excited to have you on yet another episode. For those who maybe missed last week, can you reintroduce yourself to the Development Hell Dread Central audience?
Thanks so much, Josh. That was really nice. Yeah, hey, I'm Adam. I'm a curator, an archivist, and an author. This is my second book that's out today. It goes through, you know, a lot of familiar George Romero films, some going through the productions and analyzing early versions of them, as well as a lot of scripts that he wrote that are absolutely brilliant and fun and interesting and weird, but which never made it in front of cameras and which we never got to see. It's an attempt to kind of do justice to all this work that George Romero did that no executives in Hollywood wanted to fund, even though it was amazing and brilliant and such.
Yeah, so you were able to write this book, like one of the sort of most important scholarly works, in my opinion, of Romero. How did you get the keys to the kingdom? Like, how did you get access to all of these documents and scripts and basically this archive of treasures? How did that happen?
Right place, right time. I was at Pitt teaching when George Romero's archive came to the library, and they needed multiple people working on it. So Ben Rubin, who is the coordinator and curator of the Horror Studies Collection, and me, we just spent a couple of years going through over 100 boxes of stuff. Cool. It was mostly scripts, some like publicity and news clippings and photos and that sort of thing. But it's mainly scripts. George Romero was a phenomenally prolific writer who just kept writing almost obsessively. And he was an amazing writer. He was absolutely brilliant and just kept doing it. Even when he couldn't get a movie made, he'd just move on to the next thing. So, you know, Ben and I were the first people in a lot of cases to see these scripts that he had written, you know, starting in the early 1960s. Probably since George had put them in a box, you know, however many decades ago.
Wow.
And it was a blast. And I wrote the book in part, like I initially started writing it because I was just so excited about, you know, reading the script of War of the Worlds that has very little to do with, you know, the original novel or any of the adaptations, but is brilliant, or like the early versions of Day of the Dead or his Bigfoot projects, or, you know, a lot of the stuff that we'll be talking about in this mini series. That's wonderful. And I wanted to share it with the world. And I don't know, it ended up giving me a perspective on him as an artist, but also on these films that I'd seen, you know, a million times. Night of the Living Dead and Dawn of the Dead and Day and Martin, which might be my favorite of his films. And like, I just found that I was seeing something new in them because I knew everything else that he was working on at the time. All the other stuff that was like passionately important to him that he was working on. And I started to see new little inflections and, you know, themes that were running throughout his work that I had never noticed before. So I put it all in a book.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obsessed with the alternate horror history, you know, of what could have been. And I'm so glad we finally got around to tackling Romero because, like Del Toro, he has almost more unmade projects than made projects. So
no, he has much more.
Yeah, he does.
I mean, the archive has, so there are hundreds of drafts, outlines and scripts and fragments. You know, not all of them he finished, but a lot of them he did, of stuff that never made it to screen. And at the start of my book, I have just like a selected filmography of unproduced features. And I try not to use the word unmade.
I love that word.
I know. And like, I see what, like, everybody knows what you mean when you say it.
Yeah.
But he made them in the sense that, like, he wrote a script. He produced a script. He produced something. And what's interesting is the thing that he produced. And I like to focus on that rather than the like hypothetical, well, what would it have been like if he had made it?
I hear you. And but we did call it Romero Unseen, which kind of meets us both in the middle because it admits it's there. You just can't see it.
Yeah. It's a this is a gentle. Uh-oh. It's not even a criticism. It's Uh-oh. Just a gentle difference.
Uh-huh.
In terminology, the most pedantic kind of gentle difference. But yeah, so like I'm looking through, you know, this selected unfilmed project filmography. There's dozens of projects that he wrote completed scripts or treatments for.
Yeah.
And like a lot of them are super exciting.
There's
a few duds to be.
Oh, and I live for a dud, and I think like maybe the misguided stuff is almost more interesting on some levels than the really genius stuff. It all has a place in history, and I'm excited about it. And we are going to touch base on, I would say, some of the bigger, more well-known examples of projects that didn't actually get shot. But for fans that want to know more, and I'm assuming that's basically anyone listening to this podcast, you will have to buy the book, and then you will get all the secrets and gems that are to know about Romero. So yeah, I highly recommend it.
So secret arcane knowledge.
That's how I feel about it. This is precious cargo to me, you know? But, you know, this is what I love. So last week we talked about a very different project. We were talking about Romero's Goosebumps film, which, you know, was his foray into young adult horror, which he didn't get to do. This week, we're going in a very different direction, but I think this is the project that fans are going to be most excited to hear about, and that's Resident Evil. So would it be okay with you if I gave us maybe a brief seminar on what Resident Evil even is?
Go for it.
Okay, and if I make any mistakes, tell me and hit me in the face. So Resident Evil, also known as Biohazard, I think, in Japan and some parts of Asia, is like this ginormous, super famous video game series media franchise created by Capcom. So the general idea here is that players are just out there trying to survive in different environments that are infested with zombies. Not just zombies, but like other very scary mutant-esque creatures. I believe that this is actually seen as the godfather of the survival horror genre in video games, which that's pretty iconic. It saw all sorts of media produced. So yeah, we got all of those live action films that I'm a bit of an apologist for, but there's also animated films, which I have not seen, but to my understanding are better received critically than the live action stuff. There was a Netflix television series that I feel like nobody cared about. There are comic books, there's audiobooks, there's merch. This is the Hello Kitty of horror video games. There's just like anything you can imagine. It is out there. And I think one of the reasons for that is that Resident Evil is the highest grossing horror video game franchise literally of all time. It was created, I think, for PlayStation in 1996 by Shunji Mikami and Tokuro Fujiwara. Released for PlayStation in 1996. Said it's sort of like the start of the survival horror genre, and we've got zombies becoming repopular in culture, and I think that's going to be something that's really important for us to talk about today because Romero is the godfather of the zombie in popular culture. The series, though, for Resident Evil took a shift and became more of like an action sort of shoot 'em up over the shoulder third person gun game, but I think eventually it did come back around to more of a horror game. It led to a film, and that was released in 2002. There were 5 sequels and a reboot, Welcome to Raccoon City. None of these were particularly well received by critics, but they made a shit ton of money. I think this series made about $1 billion at the box office. My first question for you is, and be honest with me, what's your personal relationship with Resident Evil? Like, when did it first infiltrate, you know, the Adam Zeitgeist?
So when I was a teenager, I had like one friend with a PlayStation. I'm a little older than you, maybe a little more than a little older than you. But so I would have been, in other circumstances, the ideal target audience for it. Mm-hmm. I didn't have video games, really, especially new video games in my life at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think I only had one friend with a PlayStation for a while. So I do remember going over to that friend's house, and usually when we would have like friends over to play PlayStation, it would be for something, you know, cooperative, like Twisted Metal, just like the Nintendo 64 friends would have, you know, like Mario Kart. But I remember like one of the Resident Evil sequels coming out, my friend being so excited, and me going over to his house, and it was just the two of us, and it's a one-player game, so I wasn't doing anything except being scared shitless by all the creepy stuff that was happening on the TV screen where he was playing, and just like having no problem whatsoever shooting all the zombies. But I was scared. It affected me. And that was the only interaction that I had with it, like, until very recently. I knew Resident Evil more through the Mila Jovovich movies.
Me too.
Like, I was obviously aware of them.
Mm-hmm.
I and also, like, you're obviously correct that critics are not big fans of the Resident Evil movies, but I do feel like there is a sort of small cult appreciation, not just of those movies, but of Paul W.S. Anderson in general.
Mm-hmm.
As a director who makes, like, you know,
schlock,
we call them trashy movies or whatever, but they tend to have a few moments or like a scene or a sequence or something that's just like
iconic.
It's really great, just like really mind blowing in every one of his movies.
Yep.
And I think that's true for the Resident Evil things too.
Mm-hmm.
Like, even if you think, even if you don't like the movie, like, I feel like any one of his movies, at least the ones that he directed, like, I could find a scene where you would have to be like, well, okay, gotta hand it to him for this one.
Listen, you can say what you will about the Resident Evil movies, but that first one is a classic and I don't care. Like, is it a perfect movie? No. Is it a bad movie? Probably. But is the laser sequence in the hallway, like, incredibly iconic? Yes. Is her red dress super hot and cool? Yes. Is what's her face from Girl Fight, Rodriguez, also super hot and cool? Absolutely.
Your reference point for Michelle Rodriguez
is Girl Fight.
2024.
Yeah, it is.
Girl Fight.
Have you seen it recently? It's good. It holds up.
I have not seen it since I saw it in the theaters.
Okay, I saw. That's cool. I'm
older than you.
I saw it in theaters too, but I think when it came back around. But yeah, that is my reference point, because I'm not really a what's that car franchise?
Furious.
Fast and the Furious. Yeah, I'm not a Fast and the Furious person, so all I'm left with is Girl Fight.
Was an Avatar, literally like the most profitable, most seen movie ever made, maybe.
And yet, I would much prefer to watch Girl Fight.
Everybody should go see it.
Yeah.
And like, you should see it not just because it's a good movie made by a wonderful filmmaker,
mm-hmm.
because it's really fun to see it and then see this like tough, like butch performance from Michelle Rodriguez.
Oh,
and
it's so
like, oh, yep. This person is going to become like a gigantic movie star.
Yeah. And she really did, like, big time. So, and you get that energy from her in Resident Evil as well. The cast, great. Is it scary? Not really. But like, everything about it, I don't know. It's imprinted in the zeitgeist. It's not going anywhere. And we're stuck with it. Now, the sequels, I have less of an opinion on. I remember that number two was shot in my city, Toronto, And I think at one point you can get like a brief glimpse of the high school I went to. And we were all very excited about that.
That is very exciting, yes.
Yeah, and they blew up City Hall, which was cool too. So not a great movie, though. I remember not loving it. I think what was almost more iconic about that initial film franchise were the teaser trailers that would come out for each film that were pretending to be like... wrinkle cream and stuff. And then all of a sudden they would like fall apart and become a zombie. And everyone in the theater was like, ah, it's not a wrinkle cream. It was cool.
I missed those entirely.
Please
post some links in the chat, whatever you do.
Gotta. Yeah. They had some really good marketing for these silly movies. And I was really excited about them. I remember the first one dropped just when I was like, really becoming a horror fan too. So I think that helped. Would you say that it brought back the zombie to popular culture, or do you think that's giving it too much credit?
I would actually completely rephrase the statement.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the reason why like the 18th Walking Dead spinoff is on AMC Plus or whatever the hell is happening,
mm-hmm.
you know, is because of events that Resident Evil the video game set forth in 1996.
Yep.
Like, okay, so you mind if I be a bit pedantic and just talk about like the history of the zombie for?
Oh, I'm ready.
I'll be quick.
Please don't be.
But so zombies were this kind of like marginal sort of monster in American culture. And let's say North American culture.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Yes. For like the 20th century, like there's really good histories written that focus on the Haitian roots of the zombie myth and the stories that are based in like, they're based in racist colonial oppression, right? And like the idea of the zombie comes out of the plantation exploitation of Black Haitians. And you know, if you look at early zombie stories and like White Zombie starring Bela Lugosi, which is an amazing movie, the zombie is an analog for a kind of slave, basically. You know, like these figures who have been robbed of agency and individuality and are forced to work and do the bidding of their rich white overlords, right? The interesting thing is that there's just like a handful of zombie stories and novels and films, at least in Hollywood, usually like B movies. And then, of course, like I Walked with a Zombie, the Jacques Tourneur Loon film, which is Jane Eyre set in Haiti, that deals with this like head on, that like tries to think through all of these origins. But it's not like, you know, the zombie is like, you know, werewolf, Frankenstein, vampire, zombie. You know, it's not at that same level. George Romero and his pals, you know, John Russo and Russ Striner and all the group in Pittsburgh make Night of the Living Dead in 1967. It comes out in late 1968 in a few places. And they never use the word zombie in the script, right? They refer to them as ghouls. They're not thinking of them in terms of zombies. The weird thing is that people see the movie and are like, those are zombies. This is a movie about zombies. That's what this movie is. It's a zombie movie. And so like at some point, George Romero has to be like, well, I guess it's a zombie movie. So like a couple years later, when he writes the first stuff, like in preparation for Dawn of the Dead, this is like in the early 1970s when he's trying to get it made. He refers to them as zombies, and it's just like, you know, it wasn't what he used in the script, but just like, yeah, whatever, it's fine. I don't care. And because of the success of Night of the Living Dead, there's a ton of imitators, you know, not just in America, but all over Europe, especially in Italy. Mm-hmm. There's a ton of Italian zombie movies. And Knight's popularity in Italy and the popularity of all the imitators, that leads to Dario Argento more or less showing up with a bag of money for Dawn of the Dead. I may be simplifying things a tiny bit, but like that's kind of what happened. You know, sort of unprompted, like wanting to work with George Romero to make a sequel, et cetera, et cetera. And Dawn of the Dead inspires even more ripoffs, homages, and imitators, et cetera. And at that point, like the zombie is basically the George Romero zombie, the animated corpse that's come to eat your flesh. It's a thing that he and Jack Russo came up with for the script. But like an interesting thing is like you watch the early scenes in Night of the Living Dead. The zombie is running pretty fast. Like it's pretty agile and athletic. Mm-hmm. You know, it sort of takes making Night of the Living Dead and then making Dawn of the Dead to figure out like what is the zombie, in the sense that, like, you know, if you told your friends I'm gonna make a zombie movie, like I need you to act like a zombie for me, you need to be an extra, do me a favor, what would they do? That comes from Dawn of the Dead, right? And everybody who tried to copy it. But the thing is, through all of this, like as popular as it is, that's a sort of relative popularity. Like a gross out Italian horror movie is not something that like your mom would know about, right? Like your mom is not going to ever come across the name Lucio Fulci in her entire life, unless you've got the world's coolest mom. And if you do, congratulations. I'm sure she rules. Way to go.
Yeah.
But Resident Evil was a mainstream hit.
Yeah.
It was not just, you know, you mentioned it was the most profitable horror game franchise. It was one of the most profitable horror franchises, or one of those popular game franchises. Sorry. Like, period. And it kicked off a whole genre of survival horror, yes, but also just like Resident Evil as a video game series needs to be like, the only comparisons are like Mario Brothers and Zelda and stuff like that in terms
of size, yeah.
You know? And like, that's weird. Like, I mean, think about what horror movies are in that pantheon. Like, maybe Night of the Living Dead, but in part because of Resident Evil. Like The Exorcist, maybe?
Nothing's up there with... That would be like a horror franchise being up there with Marvel. And it's just not...
Yeah, because it's not just the one. Like, I'm just sort of thinking of, like, cultural impact of, like, you know, for 50 years, everybody knew who Norman Bates was.
I hear that, yeah.
Lay in the
icon.
Shower. And, you know, like, Your Mother Sucks Cocks in Hell from The Exorcist. And Like, that sort of just, like, cultural.
Yeah, like household.
Nation.
Yeah.
And it's not that your mom would necessarily know anything about a PlayStation game, but that like it was one of the most successful just like entertainment
vehicles. Yeah.
Like in existence.
In a way, would you say it kind of like helped mainstream horror in a way that it hadn't been yet?
So 1996, that was the release of the first Resident Evil video game.
Yep.
And Scream in movies.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like the next 10 plus years would see every entertainment production company
imitate one of the other,
just like trying to chase that high. you know, whether it was in like in good ways and bad, whether that was like if you look in the late 90s, there's a bunch of like CGI heavy big budget horror movies with a bunch of movie stars that like kind of suck. But there's also like Blair Witch Project and The Sixth Sense and, you know, Scream 2 and a bunch of like interesting lower budget things. And there's just like a lot of excitement around horror in the late 90s. And I feel like it's all because of those two things, because of Scream and Resident Evil. And even though, like, I know they're still making Scream movies, possibly question mark. Even though I feel like Resident Evil's like cultural footprint is just like remarkable. You know, like we got 20 plus years of just like being inundated with zombies.
And it's slowing down.
Sick of zombies. People who are not horror fans to be sick of zombies.
You know, and I think part of the game's success was around Resident Evil 4, where it kind of, the horror element did take a back seat, and the mainstream action sort of shooting, first third person shooter element kind of took over. And I do think there's something more commercial about that. And it did go back to horror, but I think because it straddled both worlds, I think that's really helped it with longevity.
I think so. And so Romero's critiques, and like they're not necessarily like, you know, critiques with a capital C, but you know, he was like a grumpy old guy in the in the 2000s when Resident Evil movies and films were very popular. And he was scrounging for budgets, you know. So just sort of keep that context in mind. But his reservations, let's say, about the zombie renaissance and like the fast zombies and all the zombie video games and all that, I feel like it basically came down to a difference between him seeing the zombies as like this existential monster about like confronting death, you know, and like the inevitability of it versus like a fast running zombie who he liked to joke seemed to have a gym membership.
That's funny. Good for him.
But that just was basically like morally convenient target fodder.
Okay, so he was not a fan of 28 Days Later, I guess.
I don't think he ever addressed that I know, like, specifically. I mean, this is me reading into it a little, like reading between the lines. But there is a difference between the like slowly encroaching representatives of death in George Romero's movies versus like, well, there's somebody that it's fun to shoot because I don't have to worry about like, are they an actual person or not?
And it was this pedigree too that was the reason Capcom, this like giant organization, brought Romero into the fold in 1998 to potentially direct their like big property into a feature film, Resident Evil. So maybe we'll jump in just a little bit into what the world of Romero's Resident Evil was going to look like. He sat with GameSpot, I think maybe back in 98 or the early 2000s, where he gave a sort of a brief glimpse of what it would look like. So would it be okay if I shared with us what he said? I'm hopeful that it can be just as dark and chilling like the game. Good zombies, good makeup, good effects. I've had the advantage doing my zombie films of not having to have them rated. I think for the US release, it's going to have to fall within R because it's going to be an expensive film and nobody's going to take a chance of letting it go unrated. And I think in a little bit, we're going to talk about why his iteration ultimately got the sack. But before we get there, I want to talk about, you know, why he got hired. So we just mentioned that, yeah, I mean, like, he is the godfather of zombie in pop culture, but he had also been involved with the Resident Evil franchise prior to getting asked to adapt the film. Do you want to talk to us a little bit about Romero's first involvement with the Resident Evil franchise?
He directed a commercial for Biohazard 2, which is the sequel to Resident Evil in Japan. It was a commercial made for the Japanese market. It starred, oh God, what's his name?
Yes, it's, what was his name? Oh, Brad Renfro and Adrian France.
Brad Renfro was the one that I was thinking of. He was a great actor, but like a troubled sort of kid. He's no longer with us. Yeah. Very sad story. but yeah, so it stars him. And that was Romero's first intersection the Resident Evil games. Like, you know, he was in his late 40s at that point. Not exactly a like PlayStation enthusiast. He may or may not have been aware of their existence before he was hired. But that was the first thing that he did for them. It stars Brad Renfro, who was a child actor who was growing into like an extremely talented young actor, but who was very troubled and had addiction problems and is no longer with us. But he is missed. He was really wonderful in the few things that he was in. It's, you know, just a short 30-second thing with him and an actress, you know, running away from zombies and such, made for Japan under the name like Biohazard 2, which was the original title. There is a reason why it was titled Resident Evil in America, like probably something else that was titled Biohazard. I assume, and I also assume that there are 10 million listeners right now yelling
at us from their cars. Yes.
Not knowing this.
Sorry, guys.
I am a film scholar.
Me too.
I have written about games and researched them, but I am not an expert.
Doing our best, guys. We promise.
I do welcome corrections.
I don't.
I welcome your comments. An idiot I am. But so that was Romero's first encounter, his first intersection with the Resident Evil franchise. And that somehow led to discussions about a feature, which was, you know, for a horror fan in the 1990s, the just ultimate fantastical dream that was too wonderful to actually like come true, right? Like seeing George Romero, who had not had a film in theaters for a while.
I know.
And it certainly, and had not had a film that people, that really landed with audiences for more than a decade at that point.
Yeah.
And, you know, honestly, like as much as people love, rightly, Day of the Dead now, like it was thought of as kind of a disappointment because it's like a weird angry movie that was not like as fun as Dawn of the Dead, but anyway, so it had been a long time. But like for the father of zombies to be making Resident Evil, the like new leader in zombie entertainment.
But absolutely. And he also would give sort of this stamp of legitimacy on the films for people that maybe weren't familiar with the games. So I guess it would have been like a win-win for everybody involved. There's an author, Jamie Russell, who wrote the Book of the Dead, The Complete History of Zombie Cinema. And in there, I believe he states that game designer of Resident Evil, Shinji Mikami, was a really big fan of Romero. And he was excited that maybe he would create something that would sort of lean sort of into the angles and the atmosphere of the game.
Yeah. There was a lot of excitement about this, and it wasn't just coming from fans who just like wanted to see like best zombie filmmaker, best zombie game together at last.
Wow, wow, wow. I know.
I mean, it seemed like a perfect fit, right?
It did. Even though this was like very much the end of an era, I feel like Resident Evil, that first film, early 2000s, it felt like you know, very millennium, very, very future. And I think Romero just wasn't that. He was a staple of the past. He was this historical figure who had done it already. And I think that ultimately maybe the right choice for this franchise was to go with someone a little glossier, a little stupider, a little bigger, which they did with, what's his nuts?
Paul W.S. Anderson.
That's the guy.
So let's say there is a pretty good possibility that, you know, like, we would not still be talking about a new Resident Evil movie or TV series in 2024 if George Romero directed the first one.
I don't think it would have done great. Like, maybe it would have been reassessed as, like, genius down the line, but there's no way that would have made... I just don't think it would have been successful.
Whether or not it was successful, like, it has so many... George Romero's script has so many ideas in it. It has such a perspective, so many, like, smart things to say, yeah. Which of course I say in like the dumbest way possible. Is that
no,
it's smart things to say. No, it's an incredibly intelligent script. It would have been a wonderful film, and maybe something that we revisit, like in a way that we don't the first Resident Evil movie.
Well,
the first Resident Evil movie is a favorite of a lot of people, including me, but you don't watch it because you're like,
no, it's not the script. It could have been written by AI. Like, it's not about the script.
It's like, it is a fun movie that,
yes,
like,
it's popcorn, you know, action horror. Yes.
Yeah. Like, it's got like fun stuff in it. I appreciate that about it. I don't think that Romero's script would have done that same.
No, he's thoughtful and layered and metaphorical. But what I want to know, because you're one of the few lucky individuals who really read this script, I want to know what it's about. I understand that he focused his script on Chris Redfield and Jill Valentine. Am I right about that?
Yeah, so it's a closer adaptation of the game than what we eventually got.
Okay.
And I, so the story, as I understand it, is that Paul W.S. Anderson had a script that wasn't about Resident Evil, that, like,
that's always how it is. Okay.
But, like, you know, like, after they moved on from George Romero, somehow they got to Paul W.S. Anderson, and, like, he had this script and they liked it, so they just called it Resident Evil.
It's very Troll. Are you familiar with Troll 2?
Yes, I'm familiar with Troll.
Not everybody is. It's that classic Hollywood bullshit of just retitling something to make it
Hollywood is a bit generous. Let's say, like,
Cloverfield.
There's been, like, a bunch of Die Hard sequels that were just, like,
okay,
in a movie, and they're like, well, can we call the main character John McClane?
I didn't know Die Hard did that. That's hilarious.
Yeah, I think that's most of the sequels. There's a lot of sequels to Die Hard, too.
I've only seen the first one. Oh, I know the Cloverfield movies do it pretty, like, shamelessly as well.
No. Anyways, like, again, like, that is a film that I appreciate. I have not come to, you know, like, to, yeah, completely denounce it or whatever.
Me neither.
But, oh shit, where was I? Fuck.
So he had a different script, Paul W.S. Anderson, that Discord has slapped Resident Evil on, possibly.
Yeah. Yes, right. So that's my understanding of what happened. George's script, Romero's script, is much closer to the actual video game. Now, as I said, like, you know, Romero was a middle-aged man who did not grow up playing video games. He did not have a PlayStation.
Okay.
So the way that he found out about the game was by having his assistant and friend, Jason Beriford, a.k.a. JB Destiny, whose name you may know from, like, local wrestling stuff, but also who wrote the screenplay for Iron City Ass Kickers. That's what it's called.
Sounds good.
I feel so bad that I didn't have that at the tip of my tongue.
Oh, I'm going to make it sound like you did, though. I promise.
Iron City Ass Kicker.
There we go. Say it one more time so that I'm not going to talk over you.
Iron City Ass Kickers. That was the script that JV Destiny wrote as a pilot for a really fun, really funny proposed TV series for local Pittsburgh stuff. It's got a bunch of Romero regulars and familiar faces in it that Romero directed. I think they have put it out on Blu-ray now. Like, it's just, you know, a 30-minute pilot. You used to be able to find it on YouTube and all that, but you know, throwing them a couple of bucks is for putting this out is not, it's not a bad thing.
This was his assistant, and he was the one that would play it for Romero.
Yeah. Yeah. So just he played it and just like recorded it on VHS.
And then Romero would watch it.
And then Romero would watch it. Yeah.
Classic. And then like write.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And so it's like relatively close. Like the structure of the script is pretty close to what you would get playing the game. You know,
okay.
The idea of like the stars. A group of special agents going into the haunted mansion and like having the main characters of Chris and Jill moving through it.
Mm-hmm.
This one, they are lovers, but Jill has been hiding from Chris that she is in fact a STARS secret agent.
Hot.
He's a local who is part Native American. And
I'm assuming that's a Romero upgrade.
Yes. This was a period when there were a lot of Native American characters in Romero's scripts.
Okay.
We talked about this a bit last week, mm-hmm. but the 90s was Romero's most productive period in terms of writing. He didn't get to put them in front of cameras.
No.
But he was writing constantly.
And getting that bag. Getting paid.
Yeah. Yeah. He was selling a lot of stuff. Like, he was making more money, I think, as far as I can tell.
Yeah, but he's probably going 90s crazy.
Not making movies than he was, like, making independent films.
He had, like, a 10-year period with New Line, right? Where he was just developing movies that they just didn't film.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was New Line. Don't hold me to that.
Okay.
There's like a really good book that I really quite love about George Romero's.
Is it your book?
No.
Okay.
You should check it out immediately.
Is it the one I mentioned? Book of the Dead?
No. I'm sorry that I don't have this. Now I do. It's Tom Fallow's book.
Okay.
George Romero's Independent Cinema, Horror Industry, Economics. It's an academic book, but very accessibly written, and a lot of libraries have it.
Mm-hmm.
That explains like a lot of this stuff that he was doing in the 80s and 90s, and just like, I don't know, like I said, the industry makes no sense.
Yeah.
Perfect industry, no notes, exactly perfect. Nothing. I would not change a thing. You know, like if you think about it from the position, from the point of view of the like
producer studio, yeah,
producers of the studios, it's expensive to buy a script, but a fraction of what it costs to actually make a movie.
You can take risks and. That's what they do all the time. They have people pitting against each other, and it's a wild world out there.
Well, so what they used to take risks, right?
Sorry, yeah.
Rather than just be looking for like tax write-offs.
Better than now. I once had a writer producer on this podcast, one of my first guests, who Dimension Films hired him to reboot Hellraiser, and who knows when. And not only did they hire him to do it, but they also hired Clive Barker at the same time to do like a dueling pitch. And he didn't know. And can you imagine learning that you were going up against Clive Barker for a Hellraiser project? And then at the end of the day, nobody got the job. I know.
Okay. So I have like five different responses to that. First of all, being Clive Barker and not getting the job for adapting Hellraiser.
It's brutal.
Like that much chutzpah as like just like some random executive who nobody knows the name of to be like, Clive, I just don't feel like you got any instincts for.
Oh, I can hear them. I can see them. They need to get punched in the face. Executives hate creatives, and this is a theory I have. Okay.
But the thing is that, like, so whatever the economics of it
were, mm-hmm.
like, I could give me get two beers in me and I can complain about the film industry. As somebody who has not worked in the film industry, I can complain about it for hours. I promise I won't do that now. I promise.
This show is called Development Hell, so it is appropriate, but it's fine.
But it was enough of an enticement that it kept Romero working, right?
Yeah.
Like, it was keeping him paid. It was like dangling the carrot in front of him constantly. Like, he was getting stuff so close to production. Like, you know, we're going to get Sharon Stone to be in this, but then.
And what?
Want to be in it, and then it all falls apart.
Was that for Resident Evil?
No. This was for a movie called Before I Wake, or a project called Before I Wake, okay. That probably the closest that he came to like actually making a film after The Dark Half.
I'm so sorry, buddy. That's so
he
sad.
He had a lot of money in it. He had a lot of money behind it, but then it just eventually crumbled.
Was there any ever casting rumors about George's Resident Evil, or do you think it was just nowhere near there?
It never got to that point, as far as I know. Like, I feel like, oh God. Well, okay. So I may be wrong about this. I apologize, Ben Rubin at Pitt, if I'm getting this wrong. But I do think that there is like a document with like lists of possible people in it.
No shit.
Somewhere. But it's very much just like spitballing.
Okay, but do you remember even a single name from that list?
No. I'm sorry, I don't. You can cut all this out because it's not interesting. But like,
it is. All right. Like, well, that's cool.
But what I would say is that there was never any like serious talks.
Yeah, I hear that.
There may have been, you know, like George, like I said, spitballing about like, here are 20 actors who would be cool. But,
well, listen, I'm fascinated as someone that's read the script about, like, you know, what was it about? You're telling me that Chris Redfield is now this indigenous farmer. I hear that, you know, of course, because it's Romero, he makes Raccoon City part of the state of Pennsylvania, of course. Like, I hear that there was no Red Queen character in this, but that yes, he like made sure to use the T virus as the outbreak, and then he incorporated the antagonist Tyrant as sort of the final boss. But what else can you tell me about what was going on the page?
Yeah. So Josh,
me,
yeah, the ultimate villain. Who do you think the ultimate villain is in George Romero's Resident Evil?
Oh, I have this. I got it. Capitalism.
Capitalism. How did you know?
Because I was here last week. For goosebumps.
100% is industrial capitalism.
Okay. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing that he adds to the story is the, you know, this through line of greed and just sort of like capitalist growth driving the destruction of the human race through the creation of this T virus, which in the script is developed by a kind of like you know, benevolent or neutral scientist who wants to use it to help people, but there's military applications for a virus that brings people back from the dead. So like undying soldiers, like that's the idea, right?
All right, that's too bad.
And so the military-industrial complex is behind this thing that may get out and end the entire, like, the entire population of humans on the planet Earth. The character of Wesker is the primary villain.
Okay.
Who is, he's one of the more, like, openly villainous villains, like mustache twirling types.
Is he in the game?
Okay. What?
Well, we don't know, but he's in the script. Okay.
I think
we don't know. It's okay. We know about Romero. We don't know about Resident Evil. We're not lying about that.
So Wesker, I think that he is in the game, and I think that he is in the movies, the like Mila Jovovich movies too. But he is a figure who's a representative of the Umbrella Corp.
Yes, he is. I just looked it up.
And he is like in charge of retrieving the T virus and like sending coworkers and friends into, you know, basically 100% certain death.
Wesker. Oof.
Yeah. So he's sending people who are close to him into like deadly, you know, probably certainly deadly situations.
Rude.
To bring back the virus. And there's like a point at which he basically like, you know, kills the person closest to him, or like allows his, you know, friend to be killed, puts them directly in harm's way with the tyrant or one of the other monsters so that he can like get the thumb drive, you know, that has it. Information.
I think he was Lance Reddick in that first film, if I'm not mistaken. That's cool.
Really? Interesting.
Yeah. Okay, so this is our bad guy. Love it.
But yeah, so like, you know, it is a film in which the greed of both a corporation and this one individual dooms the entire human race, basically.
Dick.
And like kills a bunch of people that he's close with.
It happens.
Yeah.
All right. So we've got him. Alice didn't exist. She was made for the first movie. And you said that it was now a romance between Chris and Jill. That's different from the game.
It's not that it's a,
it's not important necessarily.
It's not that it's a romance. But that's their relationship at the start, and that like their character's interesting. You know, Romero, as unconventional as he was as a writer, like he had instincts for, you know, like turning game characters who were like, you know, more or less interchangeable
into real people.
Characters, like into human beings.
Yeah, he did that. He was great with character. He incorporated some things that were going to be very difficult to shoot. Where is this? Hold on. Oh, here we go. So, to my understanding, he included scenes of like giant plants that ate people, massive snakes, mutant sharks, all of these like outrageous monsters that would have been really complicated to shoot, but were, I think, like in the video game series. Do these ring a bell?
No, he was interested in showing people the stuff that they saw in the video game. You know, and like they were interesting monsters. They would have been very expensive to realize, like to actually film them, you know, with photographic cameras. Yeah. Would have been like very complicated and expensive. And it would have like, you know, it would have made the budget pretty high to
yes.
do.
Yes, it would have. I've heard that the script kind of reads like James Cameron's Aliens. Would you say that there's truth to that?
A little bit. I can see why people would say that. In that like it's you know, it's a bunch of like military types in an enclosed space with, you know, weird mutant creatures chasing after them. But I think that Romero and James Cameron have very different sensibilities.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Or wait, did you, I'm sorry. You said Alien. Not
actually,
Alien.
I said Aliens.
Okay. Okay. Sorry.
No,
sorry.
You got it right. You got it right.
I got it right. Yes.
Yeah. Very different styles.
Well, I would say, you know, okay, so I don't know where you were going to cut out of there. Sorry.
Fine.
So as far as similarities to Alien, Aliens, the interesting thing about both like the original Alien and this script, which, you know, it doesn't really resemble in many ways. But it's just this idea of like whatever the monsters or creatures are, like that's just sort of their, you know, that is their nature. And like the true villains are these greedy, you know, business types.
Yeah.
who are exploiting these creatures for money, even if it means that a bunch of just like, you know,
innocent,
unimportant lower class grunts have to die.
Isn't that how it is? Which is kind of funny because the film, and I don't know about the game, kind of reverses that, where the Red Queen, who's this like computer animated child character, sacrifices all of these characters just to save the rest of the planet. And yeah, like that's her whole purpose. So it's kind of like the inversion of what these assholes are.
It really is. Yeah. Interesting. But
now, I want to talk a little bit about why it just didn't happen. Capcom producer Yoshiki Okamoto apparently bluntly stated at the time that he just didn't think Romero's script was good, so he got fired. But you were telling me offline that this script also is just like not R-rated. This is an X-rated, like, difficult to sell, nasty classic Romero movie. Do you think that that maybe was more so why they kind of canned him?
Yeah. So as far as I understand, it had to do with just the amount of violence in it, the blood and gore,
yeah,
more than anything else. And, you know, I've seen that quote with the game designer before. And I don't know, but I take it with a grain of salt based on just like the fact that we are reading a translation of something.
Yeah.
And that like there is a sense in which the production company, which, you know, Capcom and also the production company behind the film, found the script to be just like not fitting what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And that like, you know, somebody saying that in another language could be translated as like, well, that's a bad script.
But it could have just been, it's not the right script.
It's not the right script. Yeah.
Yeah.
But what it like, at least publicly, what the producers had to say about it, and Romero basically told the same story in interviews throughout, was that you couldn't release that script if you filmed it. Like, you couldn't release it in multiplexes, basically. Like, it would have to be released unrated or rated X.
Yeah.
And that would, you know, like vastly limit the audience.
No.
Yeah. Money back. You would need to produce it for a much lower budget.
And that's not Resident Evil, or not what they thought it was.
Yeah, no, they wanted to make a blockbuster.
And they fucking did. You know, they went with the guy that had just made Mortal Kombat instead of Romero. So,
yeah, the one successful video game movie, right? Mortal Kombat?
Well, now two. With Resident Evil.
Well, yeah, but they
had, but yeah, exactly.
One guy who had done it, yeah. But, you know, they, like, you read the script, and yes, it's gory. There are people being ripped apart. There are people being chomped up and eaten.
Yum.
But, you know, like, that's what you see in the game.
A zombie game, guys.
This is just like, if you translate that kind of violence to live action, it just like,
it's a little more fucked. But doesn't the 2002 film have all that?
It's got a lot of that. It's got somebody who gets dissected by a laser grid, right?
Yeah, baby. That's my favorite part. Have you seen the movie Cube, Canadian icon Cube?
Yes, of course I have seen Cube.
I wonder if they
think I am.
I don't know. You're not a Canadian, that's for sure. But I feel like they lifted a little bit from the opening scene.
Yeah, for sure. You know, it's... it's difficult to tell how sincere the production company is being with that. Anything that you're going to say is speculation. Now, I should point out that there's a documentary called George Romero's Resident Evil that's being made, will come out in the next year or two. It's directed by Brandon Salisbury, and I'm extremely excited about it for a multitude of reasons, but like, I feel like that will be the definitive story of the behind the scenes stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's also going to, the interesting conceit of the movie is that they are staging a lot of scenes from the actual screenplay.
Oh, cool.
It's a really cool idea. I'm so excited for this movie. I will be first in line when it comes out.
Good luck. I'll be there before you. I think there's a trailer out already a few months ago, so people can check it out.
There's some stuff out about it already. There's a great story in Rumorg about it. Toronto publication.
Hell yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, so like, I feel like they will fill in a lot of the gaps that I don't know, because what I know is what's in the archive, which is the scripts. And like the research that I was able to do, just like reading through interviews, which Romero, especially like once he got older, didn't hold back. Like, yep. He would.
Why not?
He would tell you. If you had a question, he was going to tell you honestly what he thought. you know, like it's a very limited perspective that I have on why this film didn't happen. But the honest truth is that there's a million reasons why films don't happen, right? Like it's almost a miracle anytime a movie actually makes it to a movie theater. Just because there's so many stops along the way when somebody could have fucked it up.
Yep, that's the fact.
Something could go wrong.
Yes.
There is, if I could, like, you know, just digress for a second, there was in the early 90s a really fun, interesting book called Black Mariah, written by a first-time novelist named Jay Bonansinga, that George was adapting with Jay and somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
They were working on it. The scripts that are in existence are really interesting and really wonderful. But, you know, everybody along the way loved it, was greenlighting everything. But then the scripts or the early promotion for a movie starring Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock called Speed started hitting, you know, airwaves. And this movie, which was about like an ancient curse that forces somebody to drive fast or else they would die, like
bad timer,
we dried up when they were like, well, the big new movie from this other studio
is that
about this, so we are pulling the plug.
Oh, that's so tragic. Yeah, it's all about timing. And luck and wins and money and just goddamn shit. But, you know, to take us into conclusions, because now I'm sad. Honestly, I know you're a Romero guy, but I'm going to ask you to try to be, you know, take away the bias for this. ultimately, do you think Romero would have been a better fit than Anderson at the end of the day?
I think that George Romero wrote an amazing script that was faithful to the video game,
mm-hmm.
and it would not have bothered people like 10 years later. You know, after the movie of Resident Evil came out, after The Walking Dead, after like, you know, just Game of Thrones or whatever, like if he had made it 10 to 12 years later, nobody would really think twice about the gore that's in that script. In the sense of like, yes, it may still it may still disturb people, but nobody would have prevented it from coming out, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like it would have been rated R. Only adults could see it, but you could see it. And it could have gotten funded. I think that at the time, Romero just had a million ideas bouncing around in his head, and he had a lot to say. I would have loved to have seen him take this script into the actual, like, celluloid realm. Like, how would this have worked? What would it have looked like when he actually had actors in front of the camera?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, it would have been great, but also, like, it is great. The script is great. I know that it circulates, like, you know, in grayly legal sort of forms online.
It's out there.
I myself have found it by visiting the archive at the University of Pittsburgh, but I know that a lot of other people have read it, like, you know, on Reddit or whatever.
Yes, it's out there if you want it, guys.
And like, it's a great script. It's really good. It's also a first draft. Like, it would have
tightened.
It would have tightened. But also, he was a filmmaker who, even when he was hewing really close to a script, found a lot of inspiration on set and from his actors.
Mm-hmm.
So as much as we can read the script and be like, God damn, that was a good read, that's not really an indication of necessarily what it would be like to watch a George Romero Resident Evil movie. And I would really like to see that. Like, I think that it would be like the missing piece from his filmography, in the sense that we get the zombie movie of the 60s, of the 70s, of the 80s, and of the aughts. And each one really sort of takes the temperature of the era
that it was in. You're right, it is the missing slice. Because we got Land of the Dead, what, like 10 years less after this? So,
a little less than 10 years. Yeah.
That it's tragic, but you know, at least we have it on paper. At least it's something that we can fantasize about and peek at online if we want to. It's sort of available for people that really care. Now, you will be back again with us next week, but just do me a favor and let us know, where can you be found online?
Well, first of all, I want to reiterate that the book is out now. You can
today, guys,
buy it online in some bookstores. You should be able to find it in your library, but if not, hey, tell your library to order the book, Raising the Dead, the work of George A. Romero. Like every single library in existence has like a order this, like request a book link somewhere on its website.
Make them do it. Book jockeys, get the book. And you can also just go to the episode notes of this podcast and click it, and you'll be able to buy it today, because today is the day that it's out, and we're all very excited.
I'm also doing like a few in-person events in Chicago at the Gene Siskel Film Center. One of my favorite places on the planet. I will be with Dan Krause, New York Times bestselling novelist and all around nice guy.
Very cool.
On March 23rd, we're going to show Night of the Living Dead and talk George, do some like reading and book signing and, you know, watch one of the greatest movies ever made. I'm doing a thing in Pittsburgh at CMU, George's alma mater, sort of. He dropped out.
Cool.
On March 28th. And in April and May, I'll be in Boston and Seattle and Portland. And I don't know if you've got like a movie theater or bookstore and want somebody to talk George, look me up.
Wow, it's a full-fledged book tour. Very cool.
Yeah.
Awesome. And we're going to be talking about it more next week when we have a brand new episode of Romero Unseen. But until then, this was so great, and thanks for chatting Resident Evil with me.
Thanks so much, Josh. This was a blast.
This was killer.
Talking George Romero.
Thank you so much for listening to Development Hell. If you enjoy this podcast, then please do us a major favor of leaving us 5 stars and writing a positive review. It really makes all the difference in the world. We'll see you next week with a brand new episode of Development Hell.
Thank you for listening to the Dread Podcast Network.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader, like that car right in your tail. Or if you're tailgating right now, all those cars doubling as kitchens and living rooms are on AutoTrader too. Are you working out and listening to this ad at the same time? Well, multitasking pro, cars like the ones in the gym parking lot are for sale on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.